everybody. I'm Raj, and this is Blood Cancer Talks. We are a podcast dedicated to hematologic malignancies, where we bring content experts who live and breathe a particular disease and focus on the latest advances in biology and clinical management. Please take a moment to rate and review our podcast in whichever app you listen to your podcasts in. Today, we are excited to talk about maintenance therapy in multiple myeloma. We are delighted to be joined by Dr. Mani Mohiuddin and Dr. Hiramyan. Dr. Mohiuddin has been on the show before. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Utah Huntsman Cancer Center. And Dr. Mian is an assistant professor of medicine at McMaster University and the multiple myeloma lead at Juravinsky Cancer Center. So Mani and Hira, welcome. First of all, before we start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your clinical and research focus? Hira first.
Thank you, Raj. And thank you so much for the kind invitation for having us in this podcast. You know, I'm a longtime listener, so it's kind of nice to be invited. So I'm here. I've done predominantly all my training in Canada, so slightly different perspective. And as you mentioned, you know, my interest is predominantly in multiple myeloma. That's my clinical practice, as well as my research interest, and particularly with the focus of older adults with multiple myeloma.
And Mani?
Thanks for having me here, Raj. It's great to be back. I focus on multiple myeloma as well. I'm currently in Utah at the Huntsman Cancer Institute. I'm originally from Pakistan, and questions about value and questions about just the bigger picture and patient-oriented trials and outcomes are close to my heart. And those are the kind of things that I think about and that I want to research and educate about.
Sounds good. So let's jump right in. So Mani, first question for you, and you know, here, feel free to chime in as well. So first of all, I wanted to ponder upon a philosophical topic, that why use maintenance therapy? And in an incurable cancer like myeloma, what should be the goal of using maintenance therapy?
Absolutely. So the concept of maintenance in myeloma, at least, arises where in a situation where you've given induction therapy and you've substantially reduced the disease burden already, and now you want some sort of long-term ongoing treatment to keep the disease under control. At this point in time, most people are not particularly or extremely symptomatic from the disease. One would hope that you've already improved that with your initial induction therapy. So you would want some sort of therapy that is, you know, less toxic than the disease itself and can be given for a prolonged period of time to keep the disease under control. So philosophically, that's where it starts from. But I think the key thing is that you are giving some therapy for a very long period of time, right? At a point in time when there isn't a lot of disease. That is something that we're going to discuss in detail. And so you would want something that is doing more, in my opinion, than simply delaying progression, right? You shouldn't be giving a drug with all the toxicity, financial toxicity, physical toxicity, merely to delay giving more therapy later. It should actually change the trajectory, the natural history of the disease, and ideally it should lead to improved survival. So philosophically, for me at least, for maintenance, given that it's a long-term ongoing treatment, it has to be worth the toxicity, and ideally it should change the course of the disease and improve overall survival. That is how I philosophically think about maintenance in myeloma.
Raj would agree with that as well. You know what sometimes I struggle with is, like, what is maintenance therapy in that? Is it a single agent? Is it two agents? You know, we now have clinical trials where you have three agents or more that are being given for two plus years. Is that still considered maintenance therapy? And how does that differ from some of just our relapsed, you know, ongoing regimens? But, you know, I would entirely agree with Mani. Like, for maintenance therapy, the quality of life is a huge consideration as well, because this is where, you know, your risk benefit ratio kind of tips a bit over the other way. You don't have that huge disease burden. So really, you want to make patients live longer, agree with Mani. But to me, what's really important is you want them to have the absolute best quality of life. So my tolerability for maintenance is, I always tell patients, this is the best time in your myeloma therapy. I want you to feel the absolute best that you will get to do everything that you want in life and really have a good quality of life. So that's my top goal when I'm thinking of, you know, maintenance treatment.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that also, I think, speaks to, you know, why even the grade 1 or grade 2 toxicities can be important for maintenance. Like a grade 1 fatigue that's going on for 3 years can be really like a detriment to quality of life, which may not be a big deal in induction, but in maintenance, it can be a big deal if there's grade two fatigue for 3-4+ years. So Mani, can you take us a little bit, take us back into the history of maintenance therapy in multiple myeloma? As we know now, and we'll talk about it shortly, that lenalidomide or Revlimid got established as a standard maintenance therapy for myeloma in the early 2010, at least in the US. However, investigators in the myeloma community have tried several agents for maintenance in late 90s and early 2000s, which, you know, ultimately did not pan out. Can you give us a brief historical overview of that and what agents were tried for maintenance before lenalidomide?
Absolutely. So one of the issues is that we knew that, you know, whatever induction regimens we were using, and even if you were doing a transplant, we knew that remissions were often short-lived, right? So that led to an impetus to study the currently available active agents and give them in some fashion over a prolonged period of time to try to prolong the remission. So the agents that we had at that time were steroids, and we had melphalan, and then, you know, thalidomide came on the market, and then we had interferon. So obviously you can't, you know, keep on giving melphalan repeatedly. So that was out of the question for maintenance. But the things that were studied were interferon and thalidomide, and, you know, combinations of. And the, you know, I can give an example of this one trial that was from Canada. It was, you know, published in 1995. So again, we're going way back now. And it did show a PFS benefit, but there was just a huge amount of toxicity. Few people were able to stay on, you know, maintenance long-term. And then, you know, similarly, thalidomide, we had similar results with that as well, right? So there was the MRC Myeloma 9 study, again, did meet its primary endpoint of PFS. But again, the same theme. Lack of a consistent OS benefit and a significant amount of toxicity. Interferon was toxic. Thalidomide is toxic, given long-term, does cause permanent disabling neuropathy. And hence, these drugs never really gained momentum as a maintenance agent until, you know, lenalidomide came along.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we'll use that segue to go into lenalidomide maintenance. So here, let's dive into the post-transplant. We'll focus mostly on post-transplant maintenance in this episode. So let's dive into post-transplant len maintenance therapy. So as we know, there are four key trials that established len maintenance as standard of care. One of them was the CALGB trial from the US by Dr. McCarthy et al. Then there was the IFM trial, the Italian trial, and more recently, the UK Myeloma 11 trial. And all of these RCTs, you know, they randomized patients to single agent len maintenance. You know, some of them were until progression, some of them were fixed duration versus placebo or observation after upfront autotransplant. So can you tell us the top line findings from these four RCTs synthesized together? And what did we see in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival in this transplant eligible population?
Yeah, thanks, Raj. So, you know, these were some pivotal studies that really made lenalidomide kind of a standard of care really for in the maintenance setting. So there were, as you mentioned, kind of originally three large trials done, and they were all really powered, you know, progression-free survival. So not quite powered for overall survival, all comparing len to placebo. I think one important thing is to just highlight is that all of these trials, like you mentioned, are quite heterogeneous. What did they use for induction? You know, the IFM had consolidation. The consolidation len dose was 25 milligrams. Some of the cycles are 21 days, some 28 days in terms of the lenalidomide maintenance. So they are heterogeneous, and all of them were positive in that, you know, the hazard ratio for that PFS was somewhere between 0.47 to 0.57. But I think really the community wanted to know, is there an OS benefit as well? And so Dr. McCarthy a few years ago published, you know, this large kind of pivotal meta-analysis, I would say, which combined originally the three trials. And it showed by combining, you know, all of the three trials that the median PFS for len was 52 months compared to 23 months if you did not receive len and were observation alone. And what was really great to see from that meta-analysis that there was an overall survival as well when you powered all these studies together. So, you know, the median not reached for the len arm versus 86 months for the observational arm, and that hazard ratio of 0.72. So I think to me, that was kind of the first indication, okay, you know, this needs to be a standard of care. And since that time, you know, the UK group, the Myeloma 11 trial, again, is a pivotal one in the field, which again, confirms that len works. So in that trial, again, you know, the median PFS from that randomization, again, 64 months versus 32 months. And what was also so great about the Myeloma 11 trial is that, again, if you look across all cytogenetic, like standard risk versus high risk groups, you know, again, I know we're talking only about transplant eligible, but even ineligible, there was a benefit seen of all subgroups. So those are kind of the big RCTs, and you know, maybe we'll talk about it in a few minutes. But since that time, again, real world data continues to mirror pretty well what we saw in these RCTs and in the meta-analysis, really showing that the PFS, you're probably increasing it by 2.5 years by doing len versus observation.
Yeah, and you know, one more point, as you mentioned, in the myeloma 11 trial, I think Dr. Martin Kaiser et al. Had published this really elegant paper looking at the cytogenetics, and it showed that I think patients who had a single high-risk cytogenetic abnormality, they actually derived the greatest benefit from lenalidomide. And you know, earlier there was, I think, perception in the field that maybe len maintenance doesn't benefit high risk at all, but that was not true. Actually, len maintenance did benefit high risk. In double hit patients, I think the benefit was much lower, but there was still a benefit even in double hit patients. As mentioned, the real world data, I think the Canadian group published a real world data on len maintenance, and you know, I think a few years ago now. And can you talk a little bit about how the magnitude of benefit there compared to the RCTs, and what kind of induction did people receive in the Canadian real world data set?
So I, you know, the cool part about, again, real world data sets is you go back and see this is a heterogeneous group of patients that, you know, may not have all met the clinical trial eligibility. So in Canada, we have a large database, the Canadian Myeloma Research Group database. And as part of one of the retrospective analyses, you know, they looked at over 1,200 patients who got induction treatment. So now our induction treatment is different. It would be consistent of a VCD, so bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone. But in that one too, if you look at, you know, post-transplant len maintenance, you're kind of getting almost the same magnitude of benefit. So the median PFS was around 58 months if you were in the len maintenance arm versus about 35 months if you were not in the len maintenance arm. And again, statistically significant for overall survival as well, that 5-year OS, you know, about 81% in the len arm versus about 60% in the non-len arm. And you know, so that's one kind of data set. And again, just highlighting that we are seeing some of the real world outcomes as well with ongoing len maintenance versus observation.
Yeah, and in the clinic, you know, when you manage these patients on len maintenance, what toxicities do you commonly see? Like, do you often have to dose reduce? And, you know, just your real world experience. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And even though len is a simple oral pill, it does come with its absolute side effects as well. And for those of us in myeloma, we know that they can actually be quite heterogeneous. So, you know, in the clinical trials, if you look at the common side effects, again, cytopenias, rash, which I often tell patients, you know, may come on in the first few cycles, diarrhea still seems to be an ongoing issue. The other one, which I want to mention, is fatigue. You know, like you said, Raj, sometimes it's this grade one, grade two fatigue, but where patients keep describing, I don't feel like myself. I don't feel like myself. And it's hard sometimes to quantify that, but, you know, I've had to dose reduce for that as well. Obviously, the big side effects we discussed, again, are that risk of a VTE to ensure that patients are appropriate thromboprophylaxis. Secondary malignancy, lots and lots of analysis, meta-analysis done on that as well. And, you know, again, how much of it that is the len maintenance, how much of that is the entire combination of the transplant with the len maintenance. But, you know, again, a lot of the series quote around a 5% or so risk. So those are things that we watched out for. When you look back at some of the clinical trial data, you know, there's probably about, you know, 25 to 30% of the patients that had at least one treatment emergent adverse event that led them to discontinue the len maintenance when you'd pooled the US and the IFM trials. So it is an effective therapy, but I would add that it does have toxicities that need to be managed, and they're often managed with dose reduction. So I have some patients, you know, who are on len 10, some on 5. I have some on 5 milligrams Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And we don't really have good, robust data to say, you know, once you dose reduce it down that much, are you still getting benefit? I think we are, but we, just like all of myeloma, we don't have really good dosing strategies. So in clinic, as long as they can remain on len, I try to do it even if it's a small dose.
Yeah. So, you know, before we go on further, I just wanted to highlight this point again that, you know, all of these RCTs that we have mentioned, the seminal trials that led to land maintenance, they had kind of suboptimal induction regimen as per today's standard. They had either, you know, Revlimid dexamethasone or MPR, that's melphalan prednisone, lenalidomide. You know, none of them even had uniformly like VRD even, let alone Dara VRD or Dara KRD, the quadruplet regimens. And I think I first heard this point from Dr. Costa a few years ago when in one of the presentations he had mentioned that len maintenance was developed on the backbone of doublets. And before that, I actually never thought about it in that way, that the pre-maintenance treatment is also very important when we are, you know, evaluating a particular maintenance strategy. And, you know, here it's very evident that how the induction regimen was suboptimal. So Mani, now we'll go on to the next topic of other maintenance strategies. So as you know, a prevailing dogma in the field is to use doublet maintenance with a PI and an IMiD together in patients with high-risk myeloma. You know, up until recently, we did not have any randomized trial comparing doublet maintenance versus single-agent len maintenance in high-risk patients. Can you tell us a little bit about the rationale behind that recommendation and what were the studies that led to that recommendation that we were, you know, many of us were doing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it starts again with a broad philosophical principle that when you know that outcomes are going to be bad for a certain cohort of patients, you want to do more. And sometimes that wanting to do more is not based in high quality evidence. And, you know, we all have this feeling, right? Like we know that outcomes with just the current maintenance agents we have are not good. So you want to do more than that. So the main rationale for Velcade plus Revlimid maintenance comes from a very old study. It's called the Hovind 65 study. And then it comes also from a retrospective study. And I want to highlight both of them because both of them have very important limitations and it's very important to put them in context. The Hovind 65 study, again, very ancient study, phase 3 trial of bortezomib, doxorubicin, and dexamethasone versus vincristine, doxorubicin, dexamethasone. These are not regimens we use currently in the United States or, you know, in a lot of the world. And the arm that received bortezomib initially also went on to receive bortezomib as maintenance. And the arm that did not receive the bortezomib as in induction therapy got thalidomide as maintenance. So basically, you're comparing bortezomib or thalidomide as maintenance strategies. But you have to realize that the bortezomib arm in the maintenance is also getting bortezomib in induction. So it's hard to isolate the effect of bortezomib in induction versus in maintenance, which is not a new problem. We're still dealing with this problem in newer myeloma trials. So this showed that, you know, the bortezomib strategy was better, and especially for high risk, right? At that time, they saw that for translocation 414 and deletion 17P, there was not much of a benefit with thalidomide maintenance, but there was with bortezomib maintenance. So that led to this concept that perhaps bortezomib-based maintenance is the way to go for high-risk disease. And this was coupled with the understanding that from the pivotal trials that led to the approval of Len, we weren't seeing that much of a benefit in high-risk disease. As you pointed out, we were, but it was much less of a benefit. So Len alone wasn't enough. Bortezomib was showing some benefit in a flawed study that is hard to extrapolate, but that led to this, you know, rationale for perhaps using bortezomib and Revlimid. One study that, despite being retrospective and despite being a very small study, has tremendously impacted the shape of maintenance in our field, and that was a study that was published by AJ Nuka in leukemia in 2014. It was a data set from Emory. They only had 45 patients with high-risk disease, and they gave them, you know, long-term continuous VRD. So Velcade Revlimid Dex was continued as a maintenance strategy. They defined high risk as 414, 1416, you know, deletion 17P. And the median PFS, what they showed with continuing to give these three agents was 32 months, which is very good, relatively speaking, for high-risk disease. One of the things that I've struggled with, because I've gone back to that paper so many times, is, you know, it's really hard to know that a single center retrospective study of 45 people, I've read the paper multiple times. It's hard for me to figure out how many people did they intend to give this regimen to, how many actually completed, what was the attrition rate, like what's the denominator here? They just write the experience of 45 people who got this long-term VRD maintenance, which is hard to do in clinical practice, right? Like continue to give VRD long-term with all the risks of neuropathy and the toxicity, but it shaped practice profoundly. And the combination of these two studies and, you know, a few other studies as well continues to influence recommendations and guidelines where, you know, even if you look at the Mayo Clinic guidelines today, you will still see bortezomib plus Revlimid as an option for high-risk disease based on this data, a lot of which is not even applicable anymore to patients that we see today.
And here in Canada, have you been able to give like bortezomib in the given that there is no randomized control trial data, or is it not reimbursed there?
So I think, you know, a part of it, which we'll touch on maybe later on as well, is also what you got for induction, right? So perhaps in the era of quadruplet, I'm not exactly sure what the dual maintenance of a PI IMiD is going to be. But in a place like Canada, where, you know, we still had VCD induction, if I'm seeing a patient high risk, I know I've given them suboptimal induction. I know my rates of kind of MRD negativity, you know, are going to be extremely low. So I'm hoping that I can actually convert a lot more people from the MRD positive to negative. And the only, you know, way is to potentially try to use multi-drug agents in a high-risk setting. So we have been, len maintenance is our standard of care, and then we are able to access bortezomib kind of compassionately, 1.3 milligrams per meter squared given every 2 weeks. And then I, again, similar to the HOVON 65, do it for about 2 years and then stop. Again,
so you were able to access Velcade.
Yes, we are able to access it. So that is one of our standards of care for high-risk patients.
Okay. All right. So we'll go into some of the randomized trials now, because we do have actually some randomized trials now comparing doublet versus single maintenance. And I think it's important to know what doesn't work as well. So we'll go over quickly over three randomized trials, the Forte trial, Atlas trial, and then the last one is the Spanish trial. So first of all, let's quickly go over the Forte trial. So for the audience, the Forte trial was a randomized trial from Italy. So what they did was they randomized patients for induction to KRD with transplant, KRD without transplant, and KCD with transplant. And then after induction plus transplant, there was a second randomization to KR versus R. So the control arm was single agent len maintenance. The experimental arm was KR, carfilzomib, and len maintenance. So Mani, can you tell us the top line results of this trial, a Forte trial, the maintenance part of it?
Absolutely. So it's important to know that this is a phase two study, even though it's a very large phase two study, but we have to take these results with a grain of salt, knowing that it's phase two. And so there was a 3-year PFS difference between KR versus R. It was only 10%. And I sort of, this is very important to highlight, because I have this discussion very often with my patients, and I tell them 10% additional risk PFS benefit, OS benefit unknown with the use of doublet versus len alone. I think that it's important to note that this benefit was seen for both high risk disease and for the standard risk disease. And the outcomes for those who had two or more high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities was poor with both the K plus R arm and the R arm. And then it was important to note that with the addition of carfilzomib to Revlimid, we did see increased risk of the toxicities that are well known to occur with carfilzomib. So there was increased risk of cardiac toxicities. There was an increased risk of hypertension, venous thromboembolism, and thrombotic microangiopathies. And with a median follow-up of, I believe, 3 years, we still haven't yet seen an OS benefit. So yes, it is a positive study, but it is a phase two studies, and we don't have, nor is it powered for an OS benefit.
All right. And then there was another trial, the Atlas trial, which was KRD versus R. So it was, as Hira was saying, the three drugs, you know, can we really call that maintenance? And that also showed a PFS benefit, I think, of about 18 months in favor of KRD. There is no overall survival benefit thus far at a median follow-up of about 3 years. And Amani, I think you had written a paper in Nature Reviews Clinical Oncology on some issues with censoring of that trial. So, I mean, the PFS message is the same here as Forte trial, but can you tell us a little bit about that issue with censoring, and how does that impact your interpretation of the PFS results?
Absolutely. I've been very harsh on the Atlas trial, and I continue to have very strong feelings about it. I will say, before I answer your question, that at ASH 2023, I did meet the PI of the Atlas trial. We had a very good discussion, and, you know, it served a valuable role in Poland at that time, because it allowed patients to get higher quality maintenance than what they would have gotten otherwise, because it was a way to get len maintenance for the control arm, which might have been difficult to get otherwise at the time this trial was running. Now, going on to your question, so one of the things that you notice if you look at the attrition diagram is that there were lots of people that discontinued due to either patient preference or physician reason in the KRD arm. All right. So if you compare these rates of discontinuation, it's 16 out of 93 for these kind of reasons, not toxicity, not progression, not death. 16 out of 93 in the KRD arm and 5 out of 87 in the Revlimid arm. So this raises a question, right? So this is not being coded as toxicity, but people are still leaving, right? So people are not happy with having to be on such intensive therapy. You can argue that the COVID pandemic and the need for coming in for infusions for carfilzomib may have played a role. Now, if you look specifically at the Kaplan-Meier curve and you look at censoring, you will notice that there are far more patients that are being censored in the KRD arm compared to the Revlimid arm. And I teamed up with Tomer Meersen. He's the expert in this. He's a guru in informative censoring and, you know, doing fancy kinds of analyses with Kaplan-Meier curve. And if you start treating censoring as an event of interest, right? Because there's a huge imbalance in censoring going on here. If you start treating censoring as an event of interest, you basically find out that the PFS benefit basically disappears for KRD compared to Revlimid. So first of all, it was heavily imbalanced to begin with, right? Like you're comparing three drugs versus one, but a lot of your result is artifactual because of the amount of censoring going on. So even though this is a phase three study and Forte was phase two, this phase three study also has very limited applicability to clinical practice because of these reasons. And it's a small phase three study, right? You're looking at less than 100 patients in each arm. So that was what we wrote about in Nature Reviews Clinical Oncology.
Yeah, and finally, the Spanish trial, the GEM 2014, which compared exazimib Revlimid dex versus Revlimid dex. And I think this is one of the trials, actually Forte as well, but in this trial also patients got VRD induction. So it was the current standard of care induction. Then they got transplant and there was a randomization between MEL conditioning versus BU plus MEL conditioning for transplant. And then patients were randomized to exazimib Revlimid dex versus Revlimid dex. And after that, there was some MRD-guided treatment modification as well. So one of the advantages of exazimib over carfilzomib is oral route of administration, which is obviously preferred in the maintenance setting. But can you tell us the top-line results of the efficacy and safety of this trial that was presented at ASH 2021 meeting, I believe? I don't think we have seen a manuscript yet.
Absolutely. So this trial adds to the legacy of exazimib's failures recently. And I think that exazimib should sincerely not be used as a maintenance agent, either by itself or in addition to Revlimid. And this trial sort of highlights that, where at 5 years, the PFS was 62 versus 63%. So virtually identical whether or not exazimib was added to Revlimid. So this is a completely negative study. And again, highlights that if you probably shouldn't be using exazimib at all.
Is exazimib licensed in Canada for maintenance or no?
So good question. You know, I had really wanted exazimib to work because, again, we wanted this oral option and a lot of us had access to it, to a compassionate program for a long time. So we were putting a lot of patients on exam maintenance, sometimes as for high risk, especially exazimib and lenalidomide. So I would agree with Mani, you know, it was tourmaline MM3 first, which first kind of pointed at, okay, maybe ICSA's is, you know, not so beneficial. And then the GEM 2014 trial is really very convincing with, you know, even using modern induction therapy, there's no benefit seen. Important to highlight, which was relevant for my practice, again, no benefit seen inside a genetic high-risk group either. You know, we talked about this PI, IMID, and in Canada, we were trying to substitute exazimib for bortezomib, which again has weak data to begin with, but there's so many extrapolations that happen. And this was a great trial. It also highlighted that we were actually making patients sicker as well. So if you look at the toxicity with the exazimib, you know, higher rates of grade 3-4 thrombocytopenia, as well as GI toxicity. So that for me was actually a practice-changing study of what I was previously doing and have since stopped doing.
So yeah, the GI toxicity was very high. Sorry, Mani, go ahead.
No worries. So I'm just going to add some humor and levity here. So there, I'm going to quote two of my very close friends. One, Raj, who gave this very good pearl about exazimib. So Raj told during one conversation that I was having with Raj, he's like, and if you think about how long exazimib has been in the market, drugs that have been that long have produced an overall survival benefit in at least one trial in somewhere, right? Relapsed or maintenance or something. And you, if you think about it, they have, right? Carfilzomib has, Velcade has, Revlimid has, daratumumab has, But exasimib has yet to ever show in any study with long-term follow-up, it's been around for a while, that it has ever made anybody live longer. So that's one key point. And the other key point, just to quote Aaron Goodman, is that exasimib is the most expensive laxative that you can think of, right? So it doesn't work all that well, but it does cause a lot of side effects, right? This is not a placebo. You're adding a lot of diarrhea without adding much myeloma activity. You add some myeloma activity, but not enough to meaningfully improve outcomes with all of the other drugs that we have available today.
All right. So now just putting everything together, let's go over a case. So let's say you have a 55-year-old patient, very fit, no comorbidities, with T414 and plus 1Q, so double hit myeloma, who got Dara VRD induction followed by single autotransplant and now sees you at, you know, around day 60 to day 100. And patient is currently in a CR, but is MRD positive on adaptive at 10 power minus 6. So what maintenance therapy would you give this patient, assuming no reimbursement barrier? So maybe Mani first and then Hira.
Yeah, so, I'm really curious to hear Mani's answer. So let's see. I do not know what it will be.
So this is a great question, and it comes very often. And it again goes back to the philosophical point, right? Like, you want to do more, right? For the patient in front of you, you want to do the best. And you sometimes don't have perfect data, and you don't have availability of some agents that you think might help, like, change the disease course, like, you know, BCMA targeting agent at this point or not. I have a conversation with these patients, and I do present to them, and this is again outside of a trial, I do present to them the data for carfilzomib and Len given long term versus just Len. I do not generally offer Velcade plus Len as a maintenance option. All right. And I have a conversation. I present the data from Forte, and I present the data from Atlas. I highlight the caveats and the limitation. I explain the effect size. And then there are people who, based on this data, they make a decision that they want to pursue it, and that's very reasonable. And then I will go with the K plus R route. I recognize that it's a little inelegant because you gave data VRD during induction, and now you're switching the proteasome inhibitor, but that is what I offer outside of a trial. And some people are like, you know, the effect size is not enough for me, and I, you know, want to go with just Len, which always makes me uncomfortable for a young person with high risk disease who is still MRD positive. I mean, I really want to do something more than just Len for them, despite the limitations of all the data. But that is where I'm at right now. There are situations, I will say, where I have continued consolidation with the quad for a few more cycles. Again, this is also, you know, you're just making some stuff up, and you're following the trials, a lot of which have used consolidation. So for somebody like this, I might just do a few cycles of, you know, quad consolidation and then move to some sort of a maintenance strategy. I generally am not a fan of long-term Dara plus Len as maintenance while we await the results of studies. If I am to use a doublet agent, it is usually a proteasome inhibitor such as carfilzomib plus Revlimid. I recognize that this is an inelegant algorithm. There is no, you know, excellent data here. I recognize that, you know, very reasonable people will have very different opinions than me on this matter. But that's just how I sort of assume this. And I want to highlight one really important point is, you know, if somebody was MRD negative at this point in time, but they had high risk disease, I probably would have a very similar conversation, because for high risk myeloma, a single time point of MRD negativity can be very fleeting. And I've seen this time and time again. You know, I've had people with high risk disease who I made them MRD negative, usually it's 10 to the power minus 5 after an auto, and only for them to relapse within a few months, right? And regardless of what I chose for doublet, I've had people who've been just on just Len and they've done fine, and I've people who've been on doublet who haven't. So that those are my thoughts to this matter, and it's imperfect.
Yeah.
So similarly, Mani, I think when I look at this case, this is a double hit patient for me. They're very high risk. I'm not comfortable with Len alone. So that's where I would start off with. And I would also say for this patient, I'd like continuous ongoing treatment based upon kind of optimum results, master trial. So again, in this one, I'd be interested to know the MRD, but what I want is as many agents together as possible ongoing, because this to me is a very high-risk patient. So Len's out for me. My other options are Len plus ICSA, we talked about, that's out. Again, Len plus an anti-CD38, I again do not currently have enough data to say what it is like in high risk and also what the role is, especially if you got a quad induction. So my only two options are with Len with a PI-based backbone. And I would say probably the most convincing data, as Mani pointed out, is the Forte trial. At least like I have some more real contemporary data to counsel my patients rather than the whole 165. So I don't currently have access to KR, you know, but if I did, I would use KR. Currently, standard of care in Canada would be to use bortezomib and lenalidomide maintenance. I like Mani too. Maybe just to make myself feel better, do try to throw in at least two cycles of consolidation, if possible, post-transplant as well.
Then I want to highlight, Raj, that this is the group of patients that we really need to study augmented and novel agents of maintenance. And the tragedy of the current landscape for maintenance trials, which we'll talk about, is that there's a one-size-fits-all approach, and you lump in the double hit patients with high risk disease and residual disease, they will be subjected to the same maintenance strategy and same randomization as somebody with no high risk features who's already achieved MRD negativity. They're going to be subject to the same strategy. So that's the failing with the large regulatory randomized trial looking at maintenance in this space. And there's several of them.
You're totally right, Mani. Even when I see those patients in clinic, if someone's like this and I'm looking at a RCT, which has a control arm of Len alone, I have a hard time saying, because I wouldn't be happy with that control arm. Wouldn't be my standard of care control arm. So I'd even be hesitant sometimes in putting them on those trials, right?
Yeah. And this again puts us in a difficult position. And sometimes I feel like it unveils our own, like, you know, biases, because I've heard excuses that, you know, there's no OS benefit, right, with anything more than just Revlimid, right? So it's okay to, you know, enroll on this study. But then, you know, off trial, that's not what you want to do for your patient, right? So it's a complicated situation. But I, for example, we've had, you know, S1803 open for a very long time, which is evaluating DARA plus Len versus Len. And I generally have not enrolled double hit high risk disease on that trial for this very reason, even though I acknowledge the data isn't amazing, but I just don't feel comfortable with the idea of them being on just Revlimid.
Now, I want to sneak in three quick questions, two for Hira and one for Mani, just before the hour ticks over. So apologies for the bulk of questions. But Hira, on the discussion you just had, I wanted to ask whether the approach of the master trial dividing patients by those who have two high-risk chromosome abnormalities versus one influences who you choose or who you're willing to have breaks in their maintenance versus who you think really needs continuous therapy. And then the second part of that is if you could talk about the maintenance element of the Cassiopeia trial. And Mani, the question I wanted to ask you about right from the start was, you know, you said you want an OS benefit in the maintenance setting, but if someone has a PFS benefit that lets them stay away from the infusion center, away from the hospital, do you think about that differently if it's an oral treatment that lets people stay away from the infusion center? Thanks, guys.
Sure. So I can start off by talking about the master trial and two high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities versus one versus zero. So I think the master trial was really important in highlighting that patients, even that got treated with DARA KRD, if you had two or more high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities, then you're an extremely high-risk patient. And it's possible that our definition of high risk will change as well when we have these amazing induction therapies, you know, from like a quadruplet induction therapy. So for a patient like that, I would say I want to do, as you know, continuous ongoing therapy. Again, the master highlighted for those patients, even if they entered into that MRD sure phase, they quickly progressed. For patients who are one plus high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities, Eddie, it's a good question because it again comes down to the induction. So currently for me, in my standard of care, a one high-risk cytogenetic abnormality is still high-risk because my standard of care induction is VRD. What I don't know is how is that patient going to act if my induction was DARA KRD? And the master would highlight that, you know, they're perhaps not as high-risk as I would have originally thought. And perhaps there would be a role for eventually thinking of discontinuation strategies for them. So a little bit of it comes down to the induction therapy as well. You know, with regards to the Cassiopeia trial, what we'll you know, briefly touched upon, both Lonnie and I talked about how we just don't really know the benefit of an anti-CD38 and Len in a maintenance setting. So just to summarize, you know, the CASTLE-PL was a large phase 3 trial, over 800 patients randomized, two arms. You got either Dara VTD or VTD induction. You got a stem cell transplant, post-transplant. You either got Dara for 2 years or observation alone. This trial had a pre-specified analysis where they took a look at Dara versus observation. And what was interesting is that while there was a clear benefit in terms of the PFS, the hazard ratio for Dara versus observation in that patients who got the VTD induction, so that hazard ratio, you know, was really quite impressive, 0.32, it was not really statistically significant for Dara, in favor of Dara, if you had Dara in induction as well. So I think that's one of the first things that, you know, kind of made us think, well, how much Dara do you need? Where do you need the Dara? Do you, if you get it during induction, is that enough? I don't know. And since we're on this conversation of Dara, I will just highlight our Canadian efforts as well. We'll be leading a large phase 3 trial. It's called the MY13 trial, where again, we're trying to figure out what is really the optimal duration of Dara in a maintenance setting in transplant ineligible patients. In the transplant eligible setting, I'm super excited to know that there is a trial, the German trial, the GMMG-HD7, which again uses a different anti-CD38, isatuximab, but has that second randomization, which is going to be key. And a lot of us are so eagerly awaiting for that clinical trial to see, does anti-CD38 still make a difference in the maintenance setting if you got it during induction?
So I will answer Eddie's question in just a minute, but I think one important point to highlight, and I've thought a lot about this recently, is that, you know, we often conclude from the CASTLE-PL study that if you gave Dara during induction, Dara during maintenance doesn't have a benefit. But I guess the one philosophical question I have is that if you would have subjected Revlimid to the same test, so let's say you give quad, and then it's the same study design, right? DVTD, you know, or DVR, DVRD. And then you basically randomize to observation or Revlimid. And a lot of the people are already in a very deep response and they're MRD negative. Do we think that Revlimid versus placebo would lead to a PFS benefit for patients who receive quad induction? And I don't know the answer to that. And I often think about this where maybe this is less of a thing about daratumumab being unique, that it doesn't work if you've given it an induction. And maybe it's more about maintenance probably doesn't work all that well if you've gotten high quality quad induction. That is my more recent take from this study.
I agree with you, Mani. And I think about, imagine if instead of observation, you had Len maintenance, right, in the CASTLE-PL. So if you had Dara versus, if the Dara wasn't better from observation, in at least in that trial, Dara is, you know, may not be beneficial compared to my standard of care, which is Len maintenance in that trial.
Right.
Yeah. So for me, it's even to think about that, like if I couldn't beat observation, I would have likely not been able to beat my standard of care, which is Len maintenance.
Absolutely. So Eddie raised a very good question where, you know, is time to next treatment in itself a meaningful endpoint? And I think it depends on what you're doing during the time to next treatment. So one can argue that if you're just on Revlimid and you're handling Revlimid okay, and it's not causing physical, financial toxicities, my patients hate the monthly, you know, stuff that comes along with Revlimid, at least in the United States, right? The REMS requirement and all of that stuff. But anyways, let's assume that you're doing just fine. Then it is meaningful, right? That you're staying on a pill and you're living life really well and you're not coming in weekly to the infusion center. So I buy that and I think that is meaningful. But I think the issue is that a lot of studies that are called maintenance studies are now basically doing, you know, continuous induction, right? Like things like the ATLAS study or even things like the bispecific trials we have ongoing, right? Like you're getting very intensive therapy and now your very intensive therapy given for very long periods of time may or may not delay your time to next treatment. But the thing is that you're already getting a lot of really intensive therapies. So Eddie's point is valid, but I think it's only valid if you're doing something for maintenance, which is doesn't substantially impair quality of life and is tolerated really well and is not a big opportunity cost for patients.
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, Revlimid Or let's say in a hypothetical situation, if you have Dara maintenance, which shows an overall survival benefit over Len, Dara is once a month subcutaneous injection, fairly well tolerated. I think that would be reasonable, you know, compared to, for example, Dara carfilzomib dex, where patients are having to come 3 days a month, pretty much indefinitely. So I think that's important, that how does that PFS look like? I think that it comes to that. Just before we wrap up, one point I wanted to touch upon is, Mani, a common question patients ask us during Revlimid maintenance is that, when can I stop treatment? And, you know, as we talked about that some trials continue indefinitely, some trials have continued for 1 year or 2 years. So are there any data currently to discontinue maintenance therapy based on bone marrow MRD? And, you know, how do you handle that data in your current practice?
So there is no high quality prospective randomized study that has specifically looked at this question that has resulted yet. So that is the short answer to your question. We do know, based on some secondary analyses from some randomized studies, that if you've sustained MRD negativity, or if, you know, at the end of maintenance, if you had, you know, really good MRD negativity, then, you know, your outcomes are well, even if you stay off of maintenance, right? So I think the one example here is the Spanish study, the IRD versus RD study that we spoke about earlier, where, you know, even for those who are MRD negative at 10 raised to the power minus 6, after 2 years of maintenance and the maintenance was then stopped, the 4-year PFS was still 80%, which is excellent. So they're maintaining their remission. So I have two ways of looking at this question. I know we're a bit short on time, but I'll make this quick. I think that if you're within the first few years of being on maintenance, I think that I am hesitant currently to take people completely off maintenance, you know, without good sustained MRD negativity. But the other way of looking at this, and there was a very controversial, I don't know why that became so controversial, but the other way of looking at this is that if you have had many years following transplant, 5, 7, 9 years post-transplant, I think that your disease has declared itself, and I'm generally comfortable giving people a break from treatment and taking them off Len maintenance, regardless of MRD results. That is my philosophy. I have a very informed discussion with patients about this, but there are ongoing trials that will answer this question. And I know that Ben Derman had a small study, an exploratory study looking at this. There will be further granularity based on this. I think the biggest study in this space in the United States is, again, the SWOG dramatic study that we mentioned. We spoke about the randomization between Dara-Len versus Len, but there is also another randomization where, after 2 years of maintenance, those who are MRD negative, and this is at 10 raised to the power minus 5, but those who are MRD negative will then be randomized to either continued maintenance or to stop maintenance altogether. And the primary endpoint of this analysis is overall survival. It's going to take a long time, but it's going to be a robust analysis. So those are my thoughts on this space.
Sounds good. All right. So before we wrap up, I think both, you know, Hira and Mani, what do you think is the future of maintenance therapy in myeloma? As we know, there are several bispecific antibodies which are currently being tested in the maintenance space with PFS endpoint. You know, when historically overall survival was the benchmark for using maintenance therapy, for example, with Revlimid. So maybe here first, like, do you think the regulatory agencies will approve these expensive agents for maintenance based on PFS endpoint, for example, in Canada? Can you give your perspective on that?
So I think, you know, a bit of it is, and we could even further that conversation even to MRD. I think just thinking of like the Perseus trial, where that 4-year PFS is again over 80%, we are going to have a long time before we're reaching patients start progressing. So we will need some way of A, conducting trials in upfront settings, and B, also having some regulatory agents as well. So I think, you know, when I think of the future of kind of maintenance treatment, I actually think that this is where academic trials will be needed a lot, because a lot of, again, the trials that we're seeing from pharma, which again are important, are often ongoing continuous therapy, adding in more agent. And I think with really effective quadruplet agents, I'm really interested to know, when can we pull back now? And I think that's why, to me, like, the MASTER trial is probably the most innovative trial I love in that field. You know, you get Dara KRD, the majority of patients can enter into their MRD sure phase. The majority, especially with zero high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities, are actually not going to relapse. So ideal trials in the maintenance setting should include now, you know, not one size fits all, like Mani had mentioned. We should stratify based upon disease factors, patient factors, and then also have some way of actually stopping therapy. Again, ideally, I would like the primary endpoint of OS, but I realize I'm just not sure if that is actually possible with some of our treatments at the moment. So PFS or MRD negativity may need to enter into that space from a regulatory perspective as well.
So I will go one step further and say that we owe it to our patients who are standard risk and who achieve an exceptional response to initial induction therapy, such as MRD negativity. We owe it to them to study not giving maintenance at all, for the reasons that we've highlighted already in this podcast, that the data for maintenance is really old. It is from trials where most people were not even in a complete response, let alone MRD negative. A lot of people had not even gotten Revlimid during induction. And it's obvious, right? You had a lot of residual disease and doing something like Revlimid was better than doing nothing. That is simply not the case today for people who get high quality quad induction and achieve MRD negativity. I think that the delta, the magnitude of benefit that you would achieve with Revlimid maintenance versus nothing is probably a lot smaller. And we owe it to our patients to do this study. The problem is that this study will never be done by industry. And it's a very bold study, and it's going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. And it's hard to do a clean study like this, even in academia. I'm living these struggles currently. So, but we owe it to our patients. That's basically just what I'm going to say. And I guess one last thing is that on a case-by-case basis, I have a few patients who are exceptionally well-educated about myeloma, who have standard risk disease, who become MRD negative at 10 raised to power minus 6 with induction. And I discuss the data with them, and they don't want maintenance. And I'm like, this is a bit of an uncharted territory, but I'm okay walking this journey with you. And I don't put them on maintenance, and I watch them very closely. So hopefully, I hope that is the future of treating myeloma that is standard risk that responds really well. Finite, limited therapy, master style, and then just watch off therapy for prolonged periods of time. Some of those people will relapse. My hypothesis is that the probability of those, that small relapse is probably not changed whether or not you give Revlimid. So my thoughts.
I was going to say, it's still, you know, even when you think of maintenance therapies, even that risk of secondary malignancies and how that will all pan out now with, you know, CAR T potentially being moved up front. Like, these are all actually, the risk benefit ratio really needs to be evaluated carefully in the maintenance. So Mani, I, like you, actually have, sometimes I have young patients, really young patients who are worried about that risk of secondary malignancies who, you know, for them, 5% is just too high and they choose to not be on len maintenance. And for me, I'm comfortable with that. You know, if this is an informed decision-making, that's fine. And when you come back on the relapse end, I can start something like DRD, you know, again, now an old regimen, but an extremely effective regimen with the Pollux data. And that's okay as well.
Yeah, this is the perfect opportunity to individualize myeloma care. And I think that this is where the focus should be rather than, you know, trying to play around with induction. We have a good induction, you know, system. We obviously should improve it, but it's a good platform. Start with quads, but then based on the risk status and based on the initial response to therapy, basically modify treatment. It might be very intense treatment. It might be just Revlimid. It might be nothing. That is how I think the future of myeloma treatment should be.
All right. Thank you very much. I think it was a very fun discussion. And yeah, definitely would like to have you back sometime in the future for discussing other topics in myeloma.
Sounds great. Thanks for having us.
Having us.